Well, first you gotta introduce yourself.
Is it on?
Oh, it's running the whole time.
Was it running the whole time?
It's running the whole time. It's okay. Got all the shits and dams and.
Let's see. I'm Jeff Burton. I'm the president of the Florida Redevelopment Association. I used to work in a city of about 15,000 people, my hometown of Palmetto, Florida, as the CRA director, the Community Redevelopment Agency director. Currently, I work for the city of Tampa, a small city just north of the metropolis of Palmetto. Super Bowl champions, you know, hockey champions twice over, and came to the city of Tampa and am running their four largest CRAs. And in the meantime, I finished my dissertation and was awarded my PhD from the University of South Florida in sustainable redevelopment. So,
and congrats on that.
Appreciate it.
Jeff and I have known each other a long time. We served on the board together. We've tried to entertain conference goers periodically.
We've managed to make fools of ourselves in a good way. Yep. So,
but I think another thing that we have tried to do though is pound the importance of data into the heads
absolutely.
Of the members of the
yes,
FRA.
Yes, and you know, slowly but surely they'll get there.
Yep. You know what we're doing?
Podcast.
We don't really structure it.
So do you want me to talk like a regular person or talk like an elected official and go like this the entire time?
Talk like a regular person. do not. Well, no, but that's how you want elected officials to talk into a microphone, because you don't want there to be a chance that you get caught between an elected official and a microphone. So you want them as close as possible.
Actually, when Teams and Zoom first came out, you know, everybody's like this except for the electeds. They're like right in there. Can you see me?
Yeah. And so we did the first season, kind of mainly about talent attraction and all of that. And then Ken and I last week recorded the first three of season two.
And did you leave it with a cliffhanger in season one?
We kind of did, because the first four episodes were talent, and then the fifth one was just kind of bullshitting around on a bunch of stuff.
Okay.
And then the first three that I did with Ken last week, we have kind of, you listen to episode one, all of a sudden the outro music starts. I say something and it just, the outro starts. And and that one, we were trying to figure out. So I was like, I saw this thing on LinkedIn, and then it went to the Wall Street Journal, had this article. Actually, I talk about Pinellas a little bit.
Okay.
Because I saw something else on LinkedIn, and I tell the story of it. It was a funny story. And the Wall Street Journal had an article about Miami's gold rush and all this, you know, the craze. And I know everyone over on your side is like all like irrationally exuberant about it also. There's that word from 20 years ago. And we were talking about it because it's so funny, because all of a sudden everyone's like discovered Miami Beach. And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
really? Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
rediscovered. Rediscovered.
Yeah. You know, we're apparently in the sixth stage of a project, which is, you know, praise and accolades for the non-participants.
Almost kind of like a 10-step program.
Yeah. Yeah. but we were talking about it, you know, because... You know, we always seem in Miami, we're really good at believing our own press. You know, and we compare ourselves to other cities. Those cities aren't always comparing themselves to Miami. Now, there's a lot of good stuff happening. But we're just talking about, and this is interesting for you, especially maybe in Tampa, all of this stuff happening up here with Miami. And so what we ended up talking about was really the place brand. Every place has a brand, whether you like it or not.
That's right.
And so as you have all of this happening, you know, where's that disconnect going to come in? Because that's what's, when you talk about how do we keep this sustainable, because just because they're moving here doesn't mean they're going to stay. They moved from somewhere. In Miami Beach 20 years ago, we did RFPs. We built 300,000 square feet of Class A office space. We had the international headquarters of all five major music labels. Well, now they're Blue Lagoon Office Park. They're not on South Beach.
Right.
And so we talked about, I mean, we rambled on a lot of different things, but that was kind of what prompted it. But no, so the podcast, what this is though, that we wanted to do was start hearing from people, just sort of like short clips, five questions. This is the approach we use, which what happened, where it came from was when I was in Miami Beach, we'd get these visits from cities all over, really all over the world, coming. How do you do this? Yeah. How do you do this? And we kind of would tell the story, but it wasn't a plan. You know, it was very organic. It was very private sector driven at first. And so finally, my assistant city manager and I, we sat down and we said, okay, if there'd been a plan, what were the five most important things that happened? And so we wrote them down and we said, well, we had the preservation of the Art Deco district.
Yeah.
The Army Corps of Engineers beach enhancement project.
Yeah.
Miami Vice and the obsession shoot on the Ocean Drive hotels.
Yeah.
The investment in our first P3s and really a parking garage that moved things, not just Ocean Drive, but Washington Avenue, and really started moving things out, and then capitalizing on all of that. And so we were able to kind of frame it in those five words. So when I left the city, I said, that's the approach. Because one of the things I wanted to do when I left Miami Beach and started the firm was to take the lessons that we learned there and make them relevant to any city, regardless of their assets or the resources. Because I would always hear that also. Well, I'm not Miami Beach. We don't have the beach. We don't have celebrities. You don't have to. And so this is the basis. We've used it in now about 45 communities. So it's where we ask, you know, in your community, it's how we do our public input too, because there's no wrong answer.
Right.
And it lets us get to a point, it really helps us build consensus, because usually, even if you come out with different answers, people don't come out with things that people poo-poo. Everyone, it may not be their priority, but kind of what this leads into is sort of a vision that everyone can kind of agree with. So it's what we ask about, you know, what, you know, in your community, what do you, you know, for economic growth, for improving quality of life, you know, what do you think is the best thing to preserve?
You know, we're sitting here in DeLand, Florida, and the main street that they have here is, you know, bar none, one of the most well-run, attractive, maintained, small business developed main streets, and they've got that historic preservation edge with the theater and a number, and of course Stetson University. So, and they're what, they're like 37,000 people. So, you know, it doesn't matter the size of the city. It can be, we talk about Miami, you know, there's a University of Florida report they put out every year from a group called Beaver, the Business Economic Bureau.
Of economic and like business research or
and
something.
And they do a population study every year, and they talk about 25 years from now and where the population's going. We're getting into the data here. And, you know, we talk about Miami. And Miami in Florida is, it'll always be way above at the top. There's like Miami, and then there's this big gap. And then you have Jacksonville, Tampa, Orlando, and, you know, Miami and, you know, Miami-Dade and Jacksonville, Duval, you know, those are really special hybrid type governments. But Miami is, even if it slows down, nobody's going to catch it. It's always going to be Miami. And Miami is world-renowned. When people think of Florida, they think of Miami. But even like, I have a friend that's here that sits on the FRA board, Jessica Newman, and she's in Wachula, Florida. 15,000 people in the county.
I love that town.
5,000 people in the city. And she's got the neatest little main street, and she does more with the dollars that she gets than probably anybody else I know. So, you know, we talk about preservation. You know, there's all kinds of different types of preservation. There's in Palmetto, Florida. The CRA bought the armory, which was a 1932 WPA project. It was an armory, two stories with a basketball court upstairs, red bricked. And then we bought the Women's Club, which was the 1930s. It was the first community building. They built it for $16,000. It was the first theater. And they were, we bought them because nobody else could. Nobody would pay the money, and it really wasn't that they were expensive, but what was expensive was the preservation of them, the bringing them back kind of thing. They'd sat forever. In Tampa, all day long, Tampa Theater, the Paradise Baptist Church, the Jackson House, which is this house that was right down from the Tampa Union Station that when the Chitlin Trail came down and the musicians came down to the Union Station, the black musicians could not go to the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
So they stayed at the Jackson House, which was this boarding house right near Central Avenue. And that's been a fight, but that sort of preservation, making sure, you know, we remember the past, we remember the culture, we respect these things, so that when we move into the future, we don't make the same mistakes twice. So preservation of businesses, preservation of our ecology, you know, man, so many cities, you know, you build up, but you never think about what you're doing to your environment, where your stormwater is rolling into,
right.
Things like that. So we really do have to have this more sustainable development way of thinking. And I think it's something that is evolving from just purely economics. So,
yeah, and some of the interesting ones on that. I never like to give answers before, because I don't like to, and
sure.
Same when we go to, I mean, I give the Miami Beach example, because those are a lot of times not going to be answers that they can give. But sometimes we hear interesting things. So, like, I was in one community in the preservation, they're like, we want to preserve our youth because they go to college and don't come back.
Absolutely.
Another
Absolutely.
One was, and this was one in a few CRAs where they want to preserve their empty nesters because they don't have the variety of housing stock. And so when someone does decide they want to downsize, they want to stay in their community, but they don't have any place to stay. So they end up moving away.
It's amazing, you know, no community is the same. And it's amazing what the needs are and what the vision is of the community when you talk to them. And that's what, you know, the business that we're in, that's what we have to always remember. Not to put our own perspective on it, but put the, you know, always remember to be the blank slate, and listen to the community. Even when you go, to me that doesn't make sense.
That's one of the things that Ken and I talked, because we ended up talking about housing a lot, and we talked about not just how it's more than affordable housing; it's affordable lifestyles.
Yes.
And one of the things we talked about is we have to, in our position, be really careful to not impose our preferences on as the market preferences. Yep.
Well, you know, and it's funny because I just finished this book by Jeff Speck called Walkability. It's been out for probably a decade now. And he was talking about, and we all know these things, but he really put some quantification to it. Talk about living close to where you work,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the what it costs to do that versus the amount of money you save by not having a car or not driving or the gas. And being somebody that still lives in my hometown and drives about 40 miles one way to work, you know, I'm like, I could save a lot of money and maybe have a second house near where I work and actually do better for it.
And what we were talking about is, and I talk about this all the time, is that these are lifestyle choices.
Yes.
And recognizing that not everybody has the ability to make those lifestyle choices.
Yes.
But one of the examples we were talking about, there was an article about musicians in Key West in the Herald not too long ago. and about all these musicians, they work on Duval Street, they're working musicians, but they live down there.
Yes.
And one of the things that I've mentioned again is, you know, how is it that working musicians find a way to live in Key West, but the people working at Publix have to be bused in.
Right.
And it's these trade-offs that you make. But then you've got other people who, you know, the single mother of three who has to take three bus transfers to get to the Fountain Blue working as housekeeper, to me it's just a conversation about how you be efficient with your resources.
So
in really the problem, what's the real problem you're trying to solve?
So the statute that creates CRAs, 163, it talks about you know, we're there to mitigate slum and blight, and there's this or, and it says, or if the area has a lack of attainable housing or affordable housing, or not even that, it has low to moderate income housing for the population there. So we started thinking in Tampa about, because we do have certain areas that are still CRAs that are not slum and blight as much as they used to.
Right.
Channel District is one in particular that was a big maritime area. I remember going there as a kid to drop my grandfather off. He was a ship's captain, and it was awful. And now it is, you know, massively.
I saw it not too long ago.
Yeah, there's money there. But there's a lack of affordable housing there for workers. So what we do is we take and we are using or talking about using our CRA funds to buy down the rents for people that live within that area.
Right.
So that the barista or the person that works for the cruise line or the person that cleans, you know, the hotel. And we're talking about using the HUD numbers versus market rate and then putting the money back into. So when the developer builds the 30-story, you know, market rate, $100 million housing, market rate housing, we can go to him and say, we want 10% of that, we want 20% of that.
Right.
But we're not going to ask you to provide affordable housing. You're still going to get your market rate. We're going to buy down to the affordable number. That way, we still allow the private sector to do what
right.
they do best. We don't ask them to cheat or to handicap themselves. Because on the other end of that, those buildings are appraised at by the property appraiser on income. And if you take 20% of the units and you drop the numbers, you just lost increment into your CRA.
Right.
So, and the funny thing is we're talking about this, and as we're talking about it, Pinellas County, they've already started to do it with their city employees. And so we were hoping to be the first ones out of the box
right.
on the west coast of Florida. But, you know, sometimes good ideas come. And in this market, you know, you have to be creative and inventive because, you know, the average cost of a home in Channel District right now is like, you know, $2,500 a month for 500 square feet. And no, you know, there's a lot of people that can't afford that.
Right. Well, that sort of buy down on those units is sort of an investment.
Yes, it is.
And kind of one thing we did in the Grove, in the West Grove, not the CRA plan, but in the affordable housing work, kind of is a combination of invest and enhance. What we did is we worked with a planning firm, and it's the way we work just internally, even with our planners and designers. But this was a much broader firm, and what we did is we built a model where we were testing the financial feasibility of these different types of projects, and duplex, fourplex, low rise, high rise. We probably tested about six different types of project. And we built a model. So first we started with the financial feasibility model. What's the development pro forma? What are the rents? What are the expenses?
Right.
What's the IRR? Are we hitting where we want to hit? But then we added into that model the land use regs. And so we're able to test both incentives and regulatory changes together, giving the city so many more options, because maybe if added density or reducing parking or smaller unit size or whatever those regulatory changes are can get through. In some neighborhoods they can and some they can't. But if they can, then maybe you don't, you know, maybe you don't need $75,000 per unit subsidy. We can get you at 25.
Right.
And so really trying to test different things through there in kind of merging the incentives with those regulatory enhancements.
We were doing a single variable. We were using just the market, and we weren't using the return on investment. We were using cap rates. Because it was simpler, a lot simpler.
We do have the cap rates in sort of as we flow it out to the like a 7-year buyout
right.
or a 10-year.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. And so we were because the question became this was in Fort Myers. I was doing some work for them, and do the developers actually need the incentive? And at the beginning of this uptick in the economy, mm-hmm. you know, a decade ago. The answer was yes, they did. You know, the people were going to take a risk, and but that risk also means reward. You know, mm-hmm. if you take the right risk, you're going to make the reward. And there were developers that came in and they got incentives, and they have since, you know, stabilized their properties, and they made a beautiful return on their investment.
Right.
And as CRA people, we ought to be like clapping our hands, because when they sell that, that sale goes back to the property appraiser and our increment goes up. But at the same time, the board has to look at it and say, but do we need to be giving an incentive? And if we do, what kind of incentive do we need to be giving? And I'm glad to see that you're doing that. And it's interesting to me, because I never thought of it, tying in that other variable of the regulations. That's that just, you got me thinking a second ago, and it's like, son of a gun, he's ahead of me again.
That's what we do, Camilo over there. We sit, and we do, when we look at our opportunity sites, we call it, I need to trademark the name, we call it fitment and feasibility. So we literally sit together, and he's doing the site plan, and he's doing the math, and he's looking at the code, here's what I can build, and I'm making my changes and my edits in the financial model. And then I start just asking him, okay, what if? And so he starts testing code changes and seeing how we can get, what sort of different balances we can get in it, and just say, okay, we think these are some regulatory changes we can reasonably suggest to, yes, to the city.
Sure.
And see if they can go through.
Absolutely.
And try and move it forward that way. Because the problem I have with, I see sometimes with incentives is I kind of view, I always explain the difference between economic development and redevelopment is this. And everyone has their own definitions. But to me, economic development, this is that Miami stuff that's happening now. Economic development, or it's Bala Harbor Shops, or today Lincoln Road, but not the Lincoln Road of 20 years ago.
Right.
It's a place where the private sector is taking advantage of market conditions. They're capitalized right there.
Right.
They're capitalizing on market conditions. Redevelopment is where you have to come in and change market conditions because they're not working. They're not delivering what
right,
there is. And that's where incentives, and that's where those gaps, filling those gaps comes in. The problem I've seen in some communities is those incentives become entitlements.
Yes.
And they're no longer but-fors. And I've seen this in a couple of places. And we had done one in a city where we put a cap of $200 million in taxable value, and then it's gone. But that's where I see.
There's an old saying about, you know, how we used to have to put a pork chop around the kid's neck to get the dog to play with them.
Yeah.
That's redevelopment.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's and at some point, you know, in Palmetto, Florida, there was definitely a really weak market. You could just look at the businesses that were coming in, nothing against them, but we weren't getting the higher end. We were getting the, you know, automotive parts places, and if it had dollar in the title, we were getting it.
Right.
And so we have to look at it and say, not only do we have to say economically, what do we have to do to get what we want, but we also want to incentivize environmental benefits like low impact development, and alternative energy collection, and community benefits. Like, we even asked our private partners, we have a couple events that we sponsored, and we asked them, as long as they were getting money from us, they were going to sponsor our events, and so that the community could see the benefit of it. So what ends up occurring is we ended up getting, right before COVID, a Grand Sheraton, 270 room, about a $70 million deal, right next to the convention center. And of course, the COVID hits, the financing for any kind of hotel type business, just, it doesn't go away, it just stops. People, you know, no one's renting hotel rooms because no one's moving. So they put a hold on it. Luckily, the developer had about $18 million in already and wasn't going to leave his spot. It did make their financing much more aggressive. They went and got some commercial PACE money. But the other thing was, at the same time, Marriott bought the Sheraton deal. And now we have the first Marriott in Manatee County, and it's a 270-room. Again, it's $70 million. And the CRA at that time put about $6 million into the deal over the lifespan of the CRA after they get the CO, so they're not getting any money prior to putting money in the trust fund. That's a redevelopment. In Tampa, you don't have to incentivize. I mean, there are developers lining up. They're banging on the door. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing I learned in Tampa that I was really happy with was the city of Tampa do offer incentives in a sense, but these incentives are given to the developer after they improve the public realm, to which they're basically putting the money into the streets and the side, and they have a plan for the streets and the side, right, like Water Street and downtown. And so all the money they give to the developer is actually being applied to the public space, which is owned by the city.
Right.
So it was like, I can enjoy that. I can, and the other nice thing is, Nothing against the public sector, but it gets done faster.
Right.
And since these are streets that are tied to their buildings, they tend, I think, to get done a little nicer than what we would do.
They get done a little nicer, and they're more like, even if formally the, you know, they turn over their right of way and their maintenance responsibility of the back to the public sector, they still get their love.
Yes.
That they otherwise
yes.
wouldn't. We
yes.
do that in North Miami, and North Miami and the CRA, there is a TIF incentive to help fill that gap. But there's an infrastructure grant, and it's for these public infrastructure elements that are going to have to be done.
Yes. Yeah. So the talk about Miami. Part of what I studied was, where did CRAs come from? What was our history? And you know, I went all the way back into the 1800s to find the origin of the word slum. 1920s, the word blight first appeared. But the state of Florida, they were using urban renewal agencies that mm-hmm. you had to go to the state, get permission to have one. Daytona Beach had one; they got in trouble. Tampa had one in the 50s. And in the Miami wanted one, but apparently because of the charter, they weren't allowed to have it in the 60s. So they decided to ask their state legislators to come up with something different. And in 1969, they adopted the Florida Redevelopment Act 1969 and created CRAs.
And in the Senate, when that was done, was my future city attorney in Miami Beach, was the senator, and who used to always remind me with a finger jammed into my chest that he wrote that blanking law.
Yeah. Which, by the way, Janet Reno was a state attorney on that lawsuit, which I ask college students all the time, how many of you know who Janet Reno is? And the last time that I did it, this little girl raised her hand in the back, and she says, isn't that the lady that Will Ferrell used to make fun of on Saturday Night Live? And I said, exactly, Janet Reno's dance party. And I said, but, you know, she also was the U.S. Attorney General under Bill Clinton. But then just to kind of get a baseline, I asked them all who Fred Flintstone is, and they all could raise their hand. So that tells you about the redevelopment of our youth today.
Yeah.
So,
you
know, again, Miami is usually, when people say, why did this happen in the state of Florida? I just say Miami did it first. They wanted it, and they got it. But Miami really was the origin of redevelopment.
Yeah.
So one thing I learned recently was, you know, increment revenue didn't come into play in 1969. That didn't come till later. But there were two failed state referendums to have TIF applied statewide that failed. And they finally said, let's run it through the CRAs.
Yeah, because the TIF came, I think, in either 73 or 77.
Yep, yep.
South Point in Miami Beach was the first CRA. And it was created in 77. The agency was created in like 73.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is it kind of came out of Miami. Redevelopment in Florida came out of Miami. But really, it didn't happen the way it was intended to happen or where it was intended to happen. Because what happened through that, so the Miami Beach Redevelopment Agency was created. You had South Point. Then was created in 77. It's a lot of controversy with the original board and a lot of things. I have on my wall in my office this 1982 Miami Herald article called, and it was an 8-page insert, and it's called South Beach, Where Dreams Die. And the cover, this big picture of this old woman looking through the door with the chain over it. And the city ended up taking it over. But what happened was, I mean, they wanted to redevelop South Point to the point there was a building permit moratorium. You couldn't pull a permit to do anything, even repairs. But in the meantime, while that's happening and nothing's happening there, these entrepreneurs discover Ocean Drive, and these other entrepreneurs discover north of that area and Washington Avenue and the beach. And so all of this starts building momentum that eventually just got to the point the city had to kind of get on board. And then everything just really picked up speed then and led to sort of South Beach. But they were waiting. They were playing a waiting game. And I think the developers were just kind of licking their chops, waiting for, you know, everything south of 5th become available.
Were they going to use eminent domain like an urban redevelopment? Were they going to go in and slum clear and then turn around? And
it was still a just urban renewal model that they were going to come in and do.
Some of that Robert Moses stuff from New York.
I still have some old plans. I mean, there was some of the old plans from there. There was one that I have that everyone knows, which was they were going to do that and they were going to make it into a Venice of canals.
Really?
We're going to dredge canals all through it and turn it into a Venice. I have another one where they were actually recommending to build a mountain with water slides coming down.
That's Miami.
It, and,
you know,
something,
you know,
and like parking inside the mountain.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, we can do anything when we're in Miami. Yeah. That's just the way it is. Yeah. So I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, CRAs, there are a few of us out there that we know too much, and we geek out when we talk.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff Orse. And but there's nothing else like it in the state of Florida. Because of the 1980 lawsuit, we're allowed to bypass the Florida Constitution about public funds for public uses, and we're able to work directly with the developers. How we buy and sell land is written into the statute, where, you know, the cities, they're not, or the counties, they're not. And, I mean, we're like, people would ask me, what's a CRA? And I'd say, it's kind of like, if the city to the CRA is kind of like China and Hong Kong. You know, China is always going to be this regulatory socialist monster, but they will never get rid of Hong Kong because someone's got to pay the bill. And right. The CRAs have that flexibility. And it has always not scared me, but just worries me from time to time when I hear legislators talk. They really don't understand what was created, and I don't think it really was what they wanted when they created it. But, you know, it's all about the golden goose.
That's right. And you have to be careful to not get into that, well, it can't happen here type thing when you watch it, something like redevelopment in California.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
They're all different throughout states, but what I find is we have one of the best models. You know, we've got partners and we're doing work, and I'm going to Alabama next week. We're doing a project in Ohio, Tennessee. Like, Ohio and Tennessee have TIF, but it's projects.
Yes.
It's not area.
Right.
And it's really, you know, it's and we talked about this on the episodes last week, and Ken pointed out, it's like, you know, you're doing TIF for projects, but you're not taking advantage of the value you're creating is not in the project.
Right.
It's in everything around it, and yes. You're not capturing that value.
That's one of the things I looked at was I looked at redevelopment laws across the country, looked at, and they had to have slum and blight in them because there's a myriad of all kinds of redevelopment laws. Looked at brownfield laws, mm-hmm. and looked at a TIF as defined by there was an association that did a study on them. And
probably CDFA.
It was CDFA. Thank you. And so I put them all together, and I did a search of where did they relate, and it was a really interesting outcome. But you know, Florida, you know, California, they kind of did themselves in 2013 because they had all the money, and when the state, their creator, came and said we need to talk about this, they said no. And two lawsuits later, they're all out of business. But, you know, and I was talking to somebody that ran an RDA in California, and I said, well, you know, we've kind of answered some of those questions. Their school boards in California had to pay into their increment or their TIF. And in Florida, you know, pretty much everybody's been exempted. It's just the cities and the counties.
Right.
And we have to make sure, if we're with a city, that we really do talk to the counties and find out what is it you also want, because you know, we'd rather see them as partners than as adversaries. And when they are partners, like we did a $7 million pool in Palmetto with Manatee County, the best pool in Manatee County.
Yeah.
That's all I cared about.
Yeah.
And it was in a low-income area. Yep. That kids needed to learn how to swim. And Manatee County, they were cutting the ribbon faster than we could.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it's something that we've learned, you know, coming out of Miami Beach. We had a lot of hostility at times with the county, and I think that a lot of the hostility between Miami-Dade County and its CRAs at the time, and even statewide, came out of Miami Beach. And it really came down to the success that we had and how big those checks we're getting that we're having to
yes.
go out.
Yes.
But it also, and we didn't see it. I never thought about it when I was there, but it's after I left and thought about it more and really started thinking in hindsight that we really did instigate and cause that as much as we there's a lot of times, and I think I don't believe anyone who tells me it's not the case in their community. There was plenty between Miami Beach and Miami-Dade County that had nothing to do with the CRA that was impacting that relationship.
Right.
And it impacted the CRAs. And I was in a place not too long ago where I asked that, and they said, no, they're very good at segmenting. I'm like, I just don't buy it. I think you do, you know, butterfly flaps its wings and the county sees the city.
Chaos theory, yeah, exactly.
But once I thought about it, you know, once I had left, and I have to play nice with counties because I work for a lot of CRAs and ones that don't have the leverage that we had, say, in Miami Beach. And once I thought, went back, I was like, we did not treat the county as a partner at all. I mean, we really didn't. They were, you know, where's your check?
Yeah.
And that's it. And so, you know, and I think it's part of that. I mean, we've gotten to a really good place in Dade, and Dade uses CRAs. They've got their own, but yeah, it's a lesson I always take to any of my new CRAs I'm working with is the county's your partner.
I have sat with city councilmen who are the CRA board, and we're talking about a partnership with the county on something, and they say, but that's our money. And it's funny because that particular CRA, the county paid more into the trust fund than the city did.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it may be your money, but they gave it to us.
Right.
And we really need to be nice and we need to be thankful.
Yep.
Because they could go up to Tallahassee and they have an association just like the Florida League of Cities. And they could start really and that's usually what happens. It is funny about Miami because for a long time, if there was something coming out that was friction, it was Miami.
Yeah.
And it's like, come on, Miami. All of a sudden, it stops.
Yeah.
And it's like, you never hear anything coming out of Miami anymore.
Yeah.
And you just don't ask. You just kind of turn the other way and walk away and go, as long as they're happy, then the rest of the state will be happy. Of course, that's not the case. You get Alachua County, you get...
Volusia.
Yeah, you still get some of them that, and you know...
Broward.
And we have to really work hard to be accountable.
Yep.
You know, we got the word expose here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be an open book to everybody about what we do, why we do it. And, you know, really, you know, it's funny because where I work now, I write policies and I reference the CRA plan and I reference the comprehensive plan. And I mean, if the city has something written about something and it's something that applies to us, I'm pulling it all in.
Right.
Because if anybody comes and opens that book and says, what's this policy about? I want them to see it's in the statute, it's in the CRA plan, it's in the comp plan. That way, you know, they can argue about a lot of stuff, but they can't argue about the validity of what we're doing.
Right.
The intent of what we're doing.
Yeah.
So, and it, you know, that's just something that it's good policy.
Right.
It's just, and we both know we go to places and they want to build a mountain. You know, I used the term, well, we could build a rocket ship. Oh, but it's not in your plan. gotta change your plan. So how do you do that? Okay, we can start the process today. So, cool. So what do we think about Jeff Orris and him like leaving us behind? I mean, there was a three of us.
Went to the dark side.
I know it's like I guess someone went up to him and said, you know, Jeff, I am your father. I don't know.
Something.
I guess we'll never see him again.
Maybe not, but God bless him. He's enjoying what he's doing, I guess.
Well, you know, one thing he did leave us with, if it's not in the plan, you can't do it.
It's one of the things we talk about is he did leave us with that. And one of the things we talk about a lot is especially as I'm doing data, is to always be coming back to the point that all of these preferences are individual. And that we've got to remember that when we're doing planning. And especially when we're talking about affordable housing, and we're talking about missing middle and all this. Not everyone wants to live in an apartment building. Not everyone wants to live in that neighborhood. You know,
sure.
We've got these individual choices, and we want to create that opportunity as much. And remember that other people make choices for reasons you can't fathom, like the choice Jeff Orris just made.
Yes, yes, yes. He did go to the dark side. I'm just waiting for him to come running out of there.
17 years to escape that side.
Well, you know, he's... we talk, and I know you talk to him too, and it's fun to just pick on him, and you know I still call him every once in a while, and hey, you know, what did you say about this? What did you say about that? Same thing I do with you.
Yeah, but it's definitely a great game for Delray.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'd be remiss in not reminding everybody that October, it'll be like the 11th and 12th this year because we had an issue with the hotel at the Daytona Hilton on the beach. We have our FRA conference, and this will be the last year for Jan Newton, who used to be planned. This will be her
last conference.
So if you need to come by and see her and wish her well, she's retiring. And then, just want to make sure everybody shows up to that. And
it's going to be a good time. It's right down the street,
like
in Daytona.
20 miles
That's actually where I'm staying during this conference. And we're going to have, and we're a sponsor and an exhibitor, and we're going to have a very fun theme and activities at our booth.
And you know, I hear Oris is going to be there, so. Maybe on that Friday morning, we can do the Three Egos.
We can reprise. Yep.
Yeah. That was a scary. Yep. Everybody laughed.
Standing room only.
It was who?
But
was,
but we're up against the attorneys. It's not a.
Yeah, it's not like. Yeah, it's not like low hanging fruit.
Right.
So
I think half the attorneys came to ours.
Oh my gosh! So that's coming up, we've got our ears to the ground in Tallahassee. There hasn't been any CRA bills coming out, so thank goodness for that. And
it seems pretty quiet. I know I travel around now and then, and we'll hear a board member and elected official. Oh, they're coming after us this year.
They've been pretty busy with other things.
I think they've got some other things, yeah.
And as long as they stay busy with that, then you know, the best thing we can do is, like my father used to say, don't do or say anything stupid.
Yeah.
Just let's all just keep it quiet, and and we'll all be okay. We're at the Main Street conference, and one of the things that a couple years ago. We mapped all the CRA, 85% of the CRA areas in the state, all the boundaries, and then we were able to overlay other data on top of
right.
it. So at the time, there were 53 Main Street programs, and we related them, and we found that the 79% of the Main Streets are in the CRA.
Okay.
And why is that interesting? Is because one thing I've learned doing this for as long as I have is you build this beautiful project, you spend this money, you get grants, partnerships with FDOT and Swift Mud and everybody. You build something really pretty, something really nice, and you turn it over to the local government. And if you're not aware, the local government does things at the lowest cost. I mean, they go for the lowest bid. That's what they do to provide service. CRAs, we're above and beyond. We go... And we are the artists and the creators and the thinkers.
Total value.
Yes. And so at the end of the day, you give them this great project and they're going to maintain it for you at the lowest value. Nothing against that. That's what they're supposed to do. But your trees start dying, your bushes start dying.
Yep.
And to me, when you have a brand new streetscape, what do you do with it to make sure that it gets that sustainability? And the solution that I have found is the Main Street program.
Yeah.
So, they will have a voice. If they're tied to a CRA, there's a partnership there. They do events. They get the businesses together. And again, when we talk about Wauchula, Florida, and Jessica, I tell people all the time, you can practically eat lunch off of her streets.
Yeah. Well, it's the Main Streets that are, I mean, having worked a long time in Miami Beach and that, but I come from a small West Texas town. And, the Main Streets, and so when I look at the different conferences we go to, and we look at the attendee list, and when you look at the Main Streets, and you look here, it's there's some places that are already clients and places we work, like Homestead. But when I look here, when I look at a League of Cities list of attendees, okay, I highlight this one. I want to talk to this one. Down here, I want to talk to this one. When I look at the list for here, it's okay, yes, yes, yes. It's like highlighting every single place that's coming.
Yes.
These are the places I really enjoy working. And in fact, like Wauchula, I with the office over in Newport Richey and with working in Bradenton, I'm making that drive a lot. And I always plan, every time I go from Miami to Tampa, I go through the Heartland. I don't take 75.
Right.
And I either go through LaBelle, or I go through Arcadia, or I go through Wauchula, or I go up to Lake Wells and over.
Yeah.
And because I just love these communities. And one thing I've been doing, we launched it a couple of weeks ago, is I'm giving myself time, and we're stopping, and we launched a YouTube channel. We launched an aerial channel because we've got two, myself and another one of my team members are FAA certified, which you have to be.
Yes.
Or you can get in trouble. And so I pull over, I see these cool downtowns, and I stop. And my goal with the YouTube channel is to get every cool place, every cool downtown in Florida up on there eventually. I've been to over 100 communities this year in Florida.
Wow.
I haven't been able to do the video in all of them, but yeah, I mean, those are the places. That's where you're, you know, hands dirty on the ground. You know, you're not working with having the beach right there and the celebrities right there. You're actually implementing, you know, things that have to be
grassroots.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of determination.
And it's where it's everything is about that place brand we talked about.
Yeah.
And what makes places people want to be. It's how it looks. It's the aesthetics. It's the social offerings, the activities, the opportunities to engage with each other. It's open and welcoming places. You know, I remember working with, I had another consultant, and I'm not going to say the city we were working in, but it's not far from here, and it's not the one you're thinking of. And the manager said, can you boil down the economic development plan in one sentence? And she leaned over and she said, yeah, clean up your fucking city.
Jeez. That'll do it right there.
I was like, that is it.
Standards.
Because this is a city that has huge opportunities.
Yeah.
And lots of stuff happening there.
Yeah.
But not everything that needs to be happening there. And that is really what it came down to. It's that impression. I always describe it as, if you think about investment, and you're a data guy, we can do all the due diligence we want. We can do all the data we want. We're going to build an office building, buy a house. We're going to look at schools and crime rate. We're going to go to invest in dinner.
Right.
We're going to look at Yelp. Everything works out. But when you get there, if you're just not feeling it, you're not going to pull the trigger on that price. It's like what I said to Ken the other day. I said, listen to Warren Buffett describe why you invest in railroads. And you're not going to hear him talk about data.
Right.
It's the think and feel.
Right.
That is sort of that last thing on the decision tree after everything else makes sense.
Right.
And so the data, all of that is important. For the smaller communities, especially, that becomes important.
I worked with a hotelier that he would crunch the numbers. He would look at in the hotel industry, they have beautiful data.
Yeah.
And he would say, I'm 80% there. I said, so how do you get to 100%? He says, I go to the hotel and I go in and I use the restrooms and I see how clean the restrooms are. You know, and is that data? It is. It's very anecdotal. But, he wants to see what his competition looks like, or if he's buying that hotel, how they maintain the service they provide. Because he knows, matter of fact, you know, if you don't maintain a clean, nice environment, that you're not going to get return customers.
You know, I remember asking a friend, their family, they were the ones that built, they don't own it anymore, they sold it, but they've opened some other things, both in Miami and other places, that had originally bought and redone and ran for a long time, the Clevelander on Ocean Drive. Super successful, one of the most successful spots in the state. And I remember after they'd sold it and they'd done some other things, and my wife asked him, and we knew his parents also. And my wife asked him, how do you do it? I mean, where's that golden touch? And he said, you know, when we have an idea, when we see an opportunity, we show it to my mom.
There you go.
And the ones she said yes to are the ones that always were just home runs. He said, and every time we went against her recommendation, it didn't work.
So if that's the case, what's the deal with Pete Altman?
Pete Altman, oh, don't get me started.
I mean, I think I'm still wondering. I'm like, what's the deal with that? No fan. I mean, I love Pete Altman, and I mess with Pete Altman, and he's standing right behind the camera talking to somebody right now.
Yeah, but he's got that politician nod going.
Yes, he does. He does. He's just like, yes, I understand. I feel your pain. I feel your pain.
Oh, awesome.
So
awesome.
And he's a hard worker. Well, it's it is, like I said, trying to tie all of these different, you know, state programs, local programs together and then find the money to add to it, to try and accomplish, doing a brownfield site that you're going to redevelop, and pulling it all together using tax credits, using EPA money, that's the fun. That's the probably even more fun than that is once you learn how to do that is explaining it to somebody else. And that's what I enjoy about like this and especially the FRA is we get to sit around,
yeah,
and people come up to us and they talk to us and they ask us questions, and it's mainly by experience. We've had our share of victories and successes and also failures here, yep, and there, but it's just nice to be able to kind of coach them.
Yeah.
And make a living at it.
Yeah.
So it's always been a pleasure with you and Jeff and Pete and other folks at the Carol Westmoreland who retired.
Yep.
To just kind of help guide this redevelopment along, and hopefully keep it going for as long as we can keep it going. So
yeah, no, it's fun. It's fun, and you end up gravitating to people who kind of get it the way you get it, and yeah, yeah, and you realize that there's technical things you have to figure out how to do, like the financing and all of that, but then there's also we get it in a way that's like, this doesn't have to be this hard.
No,
and it can be a lot of fun.
Yes.
Just. And that's what I enjoy about it.
Take a deep breath.
And that's what I enjoy about, we started a not-for-profit and we're doing some training on economic development training.
Cool.
Sort of like I'd done for the league a while back. And just helping, especially, again, it's sort of like these Main Street communities. It's like, this can be fun and this doesn't have to be that hard, even when you have limited resources. But we want to help you be as efficient as possible with those resources. That's where this whole thing came from.
Yeah.
Is how do we take those lessons and do them in a way where, you're not wasting your money.
It almost should be a circle, because once you get through, you're successful and you've gone, then you have to go back to preserve again, because how many cities do we know that, and we talked about Miami Beach and how many times it's almost, you almost want to use the word reinvented itself.
Yeah.
And, you get to the pinnacle and then it starts and you've got to continue to either take a breath and bring it back around again, or how long can you keep sustaining that out and having businesses come in and keeping the businesses here, picking the businesses you want.
Well, and it's true because if you look at what's happening in Miami now, you'll see and there's at least one city commissioner who's vocal about this. And I could go back any time during the 10 years since I left there. Miami Beach let it kind of slip away. And there's some of the things happening in Miami that were going to happen in Miami.
Yes.
And there's some of the things that are happening in Miami that should have been happening in Miami Beach.
Yes.
And they kind of took their eye off the ball. One thing that kind of around the time I left, there were a couple of things that happened that I observed. And one of them was that I realized that we no longer had anybody on the commission that had been part of the heart and soul of the preservation movement and the original efforts.
Yeah.
There's people who came in late, but when I started with the city, I had been with the Community Development Corporation before then, and the mayor had been the chair of the board. The next mayor had been the chair of the board. Then, and one of the commissioners had been the finance director, and so they had all been part of that. And it's not that North Beach shouldn't have representatives, but these other areas and people who hadn't been part of that story started getting on there. And by this point, South Beach is this juggernaut, the golden goose.
Yes.
And we know what happens, yes, to the geese.
Yes.
And part of South Beach's success is the fact that there was no other game in town if you wanted a return on investment.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, all these games started popping up in Wynwood and in, Design District and all these other places. And you didn't have to deal with, and the beach hadn't dealt with the parking, or the perception of parking at least, hadn't dealt with the traffic on the causeway, hadn't dealt with a lot of these other sort of image issues that they're struggling with now. And so it creates these opportunities elsewhere that maybe a little more of this. And they were getting some stuff, and they're they're trying to get back, but they definitely let some go and didn't get into the sort of reinvention or at least repositioning.
You know, and when you think of that, you talk about variables. There's that variable of where are you with where you want to be a success. And at the same time, you know, generations change, and obviously generations have different perspectives. So the people that were there that started it, they had a perspective of what Miami Beach should have been, any city should have been. And then the next generation, and of course their sensibilities are going to be completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, now I have daughters in Gainesville at school, and you know, I ask them questions all the time, because their generation, they have a completely different mindset than our generation.
Yep.
And it's like, you know, and then I started, at one time I worried about them. How are they going to fit in this world? And then I said to myself, you know, that's not the question I need to ask. The world's going to go to them because they're going to have more people in it than us. How am I going to fit in their world? And so, you know, what would Miami Beach look like with a bunch of, you know, Gen Yers? You know, Wi-Fi, no cars, everybody walking around on their phones. You know, they're doing that now, of course. But it's like, you know, guys like us, we really have to be detached from so many things in order to stay relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're sitting here talking to boomers still, because there's a lot of boomers on these city councils, and they're talking about, I wish things could be back the way they were in the 1950s. And it's like, sorry, that's maybe Disney World will come up with a 50s land or Boomerville.
It's one of the things I love about my team is, so I'm an Xer, an early Xer, but my three team members there, I got a boomer, and I got two millennials. And I got another millennial that's not here. And when we go into some of these cities, the most valuable thing I have is those millennials on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
Looking at these communities.
So does the boomer, do you have to wake him up from his daily naps?
I just let him sleep.
Do you? Sorry, Pete. He's busy.
But, you know, we're going in, when you talk about places changing, the same thing happened in Austin.
Oh, yeah. Keep Austin weird. Love
Austin. And they just move further and further away. And Austin's struggling with it. I know somebody that I've been talking to recently in the who's in the music industry. And one of the places I've been really interested in working for a long time is in the Nashville area.
Yeah.
But more in sort of the ring cities. Again, the cities that are dealing with the growth of Nashville.
Right.
But an opportunity came up about a month ago. They had an RFP out for a corridor plan and a couple of things. Not their big economic development plan that had been awarded, but they had another one. So we looked at it, and we partnered with, we created a big dynamic team that included someone from Austin who's kind of seen that and understands the music side of a city, but beyond the music industry, but it has a lot to do with identity, just like in Nashville. And we weren't selected. But the argument we were making is that we're coming, this team that's got all of this experience in Miami Beach and in Austin, there are places where that kind of went past the point of no return.
Right.
And that Nashville's not there yet.
Right.
And that there's a lot of lessons that can be learned here.
Sure.
And you know what? It could be even things that are relevant for St. Pete and Tampa.
Absolutely.
That there's lessons from these places that can be learned from a place like Miami Beach or even in Austin or some of these places.
Yeah, I had to go to Austin for work, and going through Texas, don't mess with Texas, don't mess with... And then you get to this little mecca that is Austin, and the don't mess with Texas sign stop.
Yeah.
And then the keep Austin weird. So I go into Austin, and I get off the plane, and they're like, so what would you like to do? I said, I want to go to the Austin city limits and hear some music. And they all started laughing at me. There's no such place. I said, there is. I saw it on TV. They're like, no, that's just a studio. There's actually no such place as Austin City Limits. I'm like, son of a gun.
And it's just, and I think it's, again, those different perspectives.
Yes.
Because you go there and you hadn't been there, you see it, it's cool. People who go to Miami Beach love it. It's not my Miami Beach.
Right.
And mine's the one that matters.
Right.
And that's what you hear from these communities. And so that's what one of the things I think is relevant to, like a St. Pete and a Tampa and a Nashville, is because you are the ones there, and it is the ideal it is the place you're going to remember, and it's going to be the place you're going to wish for in 20 years,
right.
And you're going to think has been ruined.
Yes.
And so what's happened in these other places that can kind of help mitigate some of that impact? So it's still a place you want to be in 20 years. Because me, I don't want to be in Miami Beach. I mean, it's not
your Miami Beach.
I mean, I will tell you that when I do go down there, which is very rare, there are times, there are places and spots, I'm right back in my neighborhood.
Right.
I'm right back there.
Right.
But overall, just with a lot of things, it's not enough that